Hello and welcome to Fitness Unfiltered with me, Emma Story Gordon, and my co-hosts, Mike and Dan. Mike, how are you?
I'm fine.
Dan?
I'm also fine. Anyone would think we're out of practice with this.
No, it's almost as though we haven't been doing a podcast every week for a little while.
That felt
where have
a little
we been?
Bit strange. Where have we been?
Well, Emma's been the most exciting place.
Mike's not been anywhere. Mike's been isolating.
Yeah, I've had the C word.
Without the C word.
Dan just likes isolating.
Yeah, I'm just a simple creature. I'm actually not a simple creature.
No, as we're about to come on to, you're very complex. But we thought we would wrap up 2021 with three life lessons from this year. So we're going to do one each. We'll do one and then we'll do two and then we'll do three.
I didn't understand the assignment.
Mike, why don't you start your first life lesson?
Okay. My first life lesson is that a sense of injustice almost always clouds our ability to see a situation logically. And I thought I would try and use this because it's been something I've been thinking about a lot recently. I think we've seen a lot of stuff like it, you know, from a political point of view, with the way of the world at the moment and how things have been with the pandemic and how different people have reacted in quite extreme ways to, you know, rules and regulations and how they feel about, you know, vaccines and all of this sort of stuff. And one of the common themes that I have found in people that have found it really difficult to kind of distill out kind of fact from fiction and all that kind of stuff is people that have had a really tough time. So people who've had it really difficult often have that sort of sense of judgment clouded. But I think it also applies to fitness and fat loss and progress and stuff like that as well, because I think we've always seen, haven't we? And I know that certainly from personal experience, that if I feel like I've been working really hard to lose weight or whatever, and then I weigh myself and I've put on a kilo or not lost any weight, then I'm more likely to throw the towel in. I'm more likely to get really angry about it and get really annoyed that it feels unfair that I'm putting all this work in and that I'm quote unquote not getting rewarded. So I will therefore make the completely illogical conclusion of I will therefore now eat loads and cut my nose off to spite my face and therefore make even less progress than I think I'm making in the first place. And it doesn't make any sense, does it really?
No, Mike, it does not. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it when you get like, I would say that this is kind of occurring with things like intuitive eating, anti-diet, like how we want things to be and what's nice and what would be fair, but actually what data shows us and what like real life experience shows us. And I guess with body fat especially, like it would be lovely if you could just be overweight. Like actually someone put this really nicely the other day, and it was beauty at any size, yes. Health at any size, unfortunately, no. Like it's not really about how you look or whether you like to be in a larger body or a smaller body, but there is like real health outcomes to consider with these things. And I think that it's a good example of where like people's own feelings or own judgments or own experiences are coming into something which should still be looked at from like quite a practical standpoint and a contextual standpoint, and whether you think that that's woke or it's not PC or it's fat phobic, like it's almost an irrelevant or it's almost like a different discussion.
It is a different discussion. I think that's the point, is that it's the separation of beauty ideals from health ideals, isn't it? And the problem is that they've always been so intertwined falsely throughout history, I guess. And that's what part of the problem is. That's why everyone thinks that, you know, people on a physique competitor stage are at the peak of health, when actually it's often quite the opposite.
I feel like that might be a bit of a running theme, and I'm not going to jump in and throw mine in because two of mine are quite closely aligned, but judgment is a bit of a running and overlapping theme there. Because on that, you know, professing to be evidence-based standpoint is that you can't profess to discuss the nuance and acknowledge both sides of the health equation if you're not describing everything within that. So very much, you know, one of mine was judge actions over words. So appearing evidence-based, appearing virtuous is the new way of almost building social currency without actually doing anything virtuous at all. So we have lots of people, and whether it's virtue signaling or not, you know, I think people have to decide for themselves, because I think when it comes to motives and things, especially with Instagram and stuff on the internet, is that not everyone is aware of their own motives sometimes. Like sometimes it is a bit of a social elevation through association being linked to certain causes and things like that. But that anti-diet, pro-diet discussion, for example, is you can't profess to be evidence-based if you're health at every size, for example, because as soon as you attach identity or an ideology to something, you're no longer evidence-based, you're no longer objective, it's entirely subjective. And often with people's messaging is that it then leads them to capitalize on it from another angle. So I know, Mike, you won't mind me saying this, because you know in present company I don't mean it at all, hashtag not all medics, but especially with medical professionals, I'm all for them talking about the ills associated with fat phobia, weight stigma, because that is very real, that's very apparent, that's very much a byproduct of diet culture and a negative message that people have capitalized on in the past. But on the same message, there are detriments to health associated with carrying a certain amount of adiposity and carrying a certain amount of body mass, especially with an aging body. And sure, context is hugely important. Circumstantially, that's hugely important. You can't judge someone's health status based on their appearance, but from having a proper, thorough discussion with that person, whether they smoke, they're engaging any health behaviors at all. So an individual that isn't engaging any health behaviors at all, no physical activity, aren't necessarily mindful of what they consume, and are, because again, BMI is kind of shit on quite a lot, but it's actually a very valid tool, especially with a sedentary population, are super high up that BMI scale, you can, from an educated standpoint, assess risk and come to the conclusion, or at least there will be some correlation in the future, that that person's health is at risk, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and all the other associated ills of being obese. Now, while that might be hugely unhelpful from an objective standpoint in communicating that message, because how you communicate it is hugely important, there is no denying that point.
100%. And I think that's the problem, is that I think we as a profession in medicine do have a lot to learn with regards to weight stigma and fat phobia. But like you say, it's just about not throwing the baby out with the bathwater and realizing that you can learn those things while also maintaining that standpoint. And I think the problem with the pendulum swing is that when you challenge a profession on something like fat phobia and weight stigma, I'm just going to for a second speak as though I speak for the medical profession. I know I don't. There's, you know, there's all kinds of different people in the medical profession. But, you know, when we think we're doing good, and when someone says, actually, you're doing something a bit bad there, we can feel incredibly defensive. It can be really upsetting. It can be really hard to hear. So when we then finally get our heads round it and think, yes, there are some improvements that we could make, it's very difficult to then not fear that you'll make the same mistake again. So you almost then want to appease that group of people by going in the other direction, which, as we know, is not correct. But it's almost like you go from allowing yourself to have stigmatized or to have been fat phobic or whatever, to then being so scared of being fat phobic or coming across fat phobic or promoting weight stigma in any way, that you almost avoid the topic entirely. And
yeah, and I don't think that's just medics, right?
No, it's
any right. Like fitness professional, yeah. Is the same. It's like, yeah. I don't want to be seen as that. And then you almost get to the point where you're scared of talking about weight loss.
Exactly.
Even though it could be the absolute best thing for your clients. And I think this is like, if there's anyone listening that's kind of that feels that way, and like I worry about some stuff I put on social media sometimes, I think coming at it the lens of like, will this help my clients? As opposed to worrying about whether, do you know what? Often some activist who doesn't actually work with anyone is gonna judge you on your social media content, which is aimed to help your clients. And the problem with the judgment as well is it's very rarely backed up with, oh, you've said something in this way, which I think is unhelpful, but here's a better way to put that across. But I still completely understand the nuance that you're trying to get at, and I understand where you're coming from. This might be a better way of doing it. It's never that. It's just that's problematic with nothing, like no helpful advice to follow. And I think that's the problem. We're not saying to people, oh, the way that you've worded that comes across in quite a fatphobic way, or maybe there's some weight stigma behind that messaging. Here's a better way to get that point across. We're just saying, we're basically just throwing stones at people instead of helping them deliver the message that they want to deliver in a better way.
It's not my job to educate you. You should educate yourself.
Do your own research.
You should magic your education out of nowhere with no help or assistance from the people. Like, and this is what frustrates me the most, is that if people have benefited so greatly from becoming so enlightened and so understanding of these really complex issues, it really frustrates me that then they decline to offer their services forward and to pay that forward, because, you know, they could actually make a difference. They could actually help people understand why they could do it differently, or they could just belittle people. And actually, that's really what they're supposed to be against in the first place. So I don't have any time for that.
Sorry, just back, because I know I crowbarred mine in judging actions over words. I think that's, you know, when it comes to, I bring that up because I think it's judgment, unfortunately, because I've got another, one of my other things was on judgment as well. It's unavoidable from an evolutionary standpoint. It's there in terms of assessing risk and a threat with people. Okay, it looks slightly different these days, but certainly mistrust in others. But when people are looking at social media content and keeping a healthy level of skepticism, I think it's important that if someone aligns with an ideology that professes to be evidence-based, it's unlikely they are. So if it is like health every size in your bio, and then you have a book on health and every size to sell, no matter how evidence-based you profess to be, you are not, because you've removed all objectivity because it's become part of an identity.
Yeah, I think the actions aligning with words, or what was the life lesson there? Judge people on their actions, not their words.
Yeah, talk is cheap.
Yeah, and I agree with that, but I also think that it makes you really self-reflect as well to make sure that your actions are actually in line with what you value. And I think that you're right. We judge other people on that. And I think judgment has got a bad name in some ways. Like, judgment isn't necessarily I'm judging you poorly. I could be judging you like positively. I could be like, oh, I love that he's done this, this, and this. That clearly means that he's got good values or whatever. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. It's just how we, I guess, assess the kind of person someone is. And essentially what you're looking for is like, what is someone else's values? And if you don't know your own and you don't identify your own and you don't frequently check in on yourself, like, did I show up in a way today, or did I behave today in a way that like is in line with my values, does actually represent the person I want to be and how I want to be seen, then you can very easily act in ways that don't align with that. And I think probably most people do that frequently, unless you're someone who frequently practices like a bit of self-reflection on that kind of level. So I like when people say that, like, I agree, like, yeah, judge people on their actions, but also check your own actions and make sure that they are actually in line with like the person you want to be as well.
Yeah, I won't go on to my other one that involves judgment, but I can't remember where I heard it or read it. But the advice was basically tell the truth. So if you had to give 100% honest account on your previous day to someone, an impartial party, based on your values and something you were trying to achieve. So let's like pluck something out there, like fat loss, for example. But then the truest reflection of your day was, I watched Netflix for 3 hours. I scrolled social media for 2 hours. I did an exercise. I ate a tin of biscuits to myself. By telling the truth, not as an introspective thing as well, but also offering the accountability to someone else, it's quite enlightening.
Yeah, I mean, I do that at the end of every day. I always ask myself, like, if I journal at the end of every day, like, have my actions today been in line with my values, like how I want to show up, how I want to live? And they're not always, but that's like calling yourself, okay, like, actually today wasn't in line. And it's not about like always being perfect. It's just about noticing and calling yourself out when you aren't perfect, so that you can plan the next day that you're not going to watch 3 hours of Netflix, even though you've got a goal of being really productive that day or something.
Yeah.
Can I tell you about a lie I nearly told on Instagram the other day?
No.
Yeah.
So I had my screen time notification from the past week, which, as you can understand, it was 17 hours something a day of screen time. Now, like, to put into context, I use a sleep app, so that actually counts as my screen time, right? So it's not as bad as it sounds. But you can imagine I've been on my phone pretty much the whole time over the last week because I've been isolated.
I feel like I need to caveat everything I said with excluding Mike because he's been in isolation.
No. But, and I nearly posted it with like a funny caption saying, tell me you've been self-isolating without telling me you've been self-isolating. But then I realized that at the top of the thing, it has a line of where your average is. And it says that it's only up 8% from the previous week. And so I was like, oh God, I can't post that because then people will know that I'm on my phone all the time anyway. And then I actually nearly airbrushed out the average line to post it. And I couldn't bring myself to do that because that was horrifically inauthentic. But I didn't post it at all because I was like, oh no, then everyone will know that I'm always on my phone, which obviously I am always on my phone.
Well, but, interesting insight into your brain, nonetheless.
I know, exactly. But it did make me think about it.
Emma, I think only fair that you share one.
Yeah.
Okay. Mine aren't really related to what we've been talking about, but I thought one life lesson or one way that I think that I've been living more this year that I think has been very conducive to like a productive life is by really living by the law of diminishing returns, i.e. when something stops becoming like productive, you stop doing it. Mm. And I think it really allows you to be more present, kind of focus on quality over quantity, focus on showing up at 100%, not just essentially being there, but not really being there, getting the biggest bang for your buck in terms of effort, and then like overall like productivity levels much, much higher. So that might look like in practical settings, like working until you can probably tell this as well, like working until you get to the point where you're kind of flipping between things, like your output is definitely going down. Now, even if you have got more to do at that point, probably the best thing to do is have a break and do something else and come back to it. So on a work level, I think the law of diminishing returns and essentially like your attention span, really important. I've also noticed it in the gym, and understanding as well, like the benefit you get from say the first like 20 minutes of your workout is far higher than the second 20 minutes of your workout. And I guess that is an example of this law of diminishing returns. And whenever I talk about this, a lot of people misinterpret it as the law of no returns, as in like after a certain point, there's no point doing anything at all. That isn't what I'm saying. Like you will still get more work done if you stay at a coffee shop for an extra hour, but you won't get as much done as you did in the first hour because you're becoming less productive. Mm. Much like you will still get the benefit from the second 20 minutes of your workout, but it won't be as beneficial as the first 20 minutes of your workout. And I think knowing that and noticing that and kind of knowing yourself and thinking this is different for everyone, but where that point is and where you're willing to keep working or not keep working on different days, or like I would say for me, it's like a couple of hours work and then a break. At the gym, it's like after about 40 minutes, I'm like, not only is my mind elsewhere, but like, I know that I'm not going to get that much more benefit from doing an extra 20 minutes to make it an hour's workout. So most of my workouts are like 40 minutes long now. Mm. And I even think this works with time spent with people sometimes. Like I would rather I got an hour of your guys' attention and time and focus and you were totally here and present than half a day, but like we both had to do other stuff. Like I guess like that, maybe that's a poor way of explaining it, but I'd rather show up for something 100% for a shorter period of time than, yeah, okay, I can be there for the full weekend, but I'm also going to have to work. Like I'd rather just be like, let's just meet on Friday and we'll have the whole day off work.
Yeah, I get that. I really like that presence point. Especially as you said, like the friends thing, it's like you can give someone half a day of your time passively scrolling the internet, for example, both of you flicking through a plan on your phones, which I know a lot of people are guilty of doing in the evening. And that's something Rosa and I try not to do as much of an evening, because naturally people just passively scroll. You're not even looking at anything. You're just scrolling for the sake of it. But even if that's an hour, you can put your phone down, give someone your full attention. That can be really valuable. It's not only more productive from a time management point of view, but actually from a presence and actually getting quality time with people. I think that's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I call this living with intent. And I think thinking about it in relation to the law of diminishing returns like helps me frame it.
I like it.
All right, Mike, what's your second one?
Debating whether or not to go for my third, because my third one is sort of directly related to Dan's previous one as well. And actually a bit related to yours. I've written, intent is the one thing that we may never truly understand in others. We may want people to do better, but when they do, we can often question why they're doing better. We can often question what their motives are. I think like it's really difficult, isn't it? Because like, A, if you're living with intent and your actions are aligning with your values, then you can be judged on your intent by your actions. But what we don't always know with a lot of people is whether they are actually living with intent and whether actually their actions are following up with who they want to be and who they're trying to be. And I think that that's part of the reason for that is it particularly we often view people through a massive filter, like just day to day anyway, but without that social media, because what people post on social media is often influenced by what other people are posting on social media, what other people are doing, what's going to get engagement, what's going to happen, how many people are going to respond to this, are people going to like it, are people going to dislike it, will it increase my business, will it decrease my business. So often we end up kind of making these huge like sweeping judgments of people, but it's not actually based on their intent at all, it's just based on these unrelated actions. And I think that that's interesting. I've been sort of doing a lot of thinking recently about, you know, benefit of the doubt and trying to understand people's intent a little bit more, or trying to at least give their intent the benefit of the doubt. And I don't really know what my conclusion is on that as well, because I still think I'm kind of learning on it. But it's interesting for me because I sort of see a lot of people on social media behave in ways that I don't think I see them behaving necessarily in real life. And I think that sometimes it can give us very, very false views of people. And I think that the one thing that people often do is they assume that social media is giving us a better view of somebody than the reality. But I think quite often, actually, it's the opposite.
Mm. I think in relation to intent, and I've been thinking about this a lot with dieting and with clients and with like how they approach their goals. And intent is probably the most important aspect of this. So like if you're, or more like the mindset around why you're doing things, but if you're coming at things like the same action, like you're saying the same outcome, but, or the same behavior, but if you're coming at it from a place of, I have to do this, I feel like compelled to do this, and almost like a bit of like self-hatred, then that feels very different and gives very different long-term results than coming at it from places like, I want to do this. And on the outside, it might look exactly the same. Like the behaviors can look exactly the same, but actually the intent really matters, or the mindset behind things really matters. And I guess that translates out of dieting and fat loss into other realms. And I think really with dieting and fat loss is you can look at someone else's diet and you can be like, oh, that's really restrictive. And I mean, there are extremes which are restrictive, but really restriction is perceived. So for some people, like going for a run every morning might seem massively over restrictive. For other people, they might be like, I love going for a run every morning. Mm. I actually want to do it. It's not restrictive to me. It actually adds to my life. And it's the same action with different intent behind it.
100%.
Yeah. My second one actually quite closely aligns with both of yours, Mike, in that my second one, which I've previously done, was actually my first one. That will make more sense, because my first one was going to be, but it was more apt at the time, less judgment, more curiosity, leading on to my second one, which was, but if you are going to judge actions over words. So I think that's very much more about self and others, so which does closely align with intent, I guess. And I have been a little bit of a hypocrite with this one this year, because often the advice that I would give to others hasn't been the same advice I'd be applying to myself, especially that inner monologue and that inner shitty committee that some of us have sometimes, because self-deprecation is a bit of a cultural thing, and you can be a bit of an asshole to yourself a lot of the time whilst you're telling others. Don't be hard on yourself. So very much from a, not just a standalone empathy point of view, but a self-compassion point of view, where you're being a bit more objective in that, why has that sparked that emotion in me? Why is that person behaving in that way? You know, why is that person talking about body image and self-worth, but posting a picture of their half-naked body for the last 10 weeks? You know, I wonder what's going on with that person, for example, you know. So, yeah, point one was going to be less judgment, more curiosity. Judgment is unavoidable. So I actually did them the other way around. But if you are going to judge actions over words. But that comes with getting to know people. And exactly as you said, Mike, how much of anyone do you actually get to know? Because is social media built for transparency? I don't think it is, because most people come or go there to make themselves feel better. And a lot of the times when people feel envious or they feel jealous or they feel triggered, whatever that emotion may be, it's over a version of that curated person's life that they want the rest of the world to see. And despite knowing that, that is heavily curated and filtered, etc., people still experience those feelings. So less judgment, more curiosity, and putting, and I think this week especially is a good week for that, that purgatory week, that week in between, because it is almost a literal thought interruption. So rather than that, whatever's happened and the knee-jerk reaction that most people have, often we need to, you know, encourage a bit of pause and thought in that space in between to objectively view the situation for what it is. So from a behavior change standpoint, people might be thinking, right, I'm going to get all of my Christmas goodies in this week, flip the switch come January 1st, and then I'm going to slash my calories in half. I'm going to go no carbs. I'm going to train twice a day. They get 3 weeks down the line and wonder why they haven't warmed to exercise or any behavior change. Whereas that rational, objective part, which they could be using this time for in between now, is slowly embedding those little things that they know are going to benefit them anyway. Walk, a couple of exercise sessions, maybe just having a few more greens, fruits, and hydrating a little bit more instead of that knee-jerk response.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Okay, my next one was how not to be average. And it was do what most people don't. And I think it's just an interesting observation that, I guess the primary one within our industry is like most diets fail. And I think people use like average outcomes as a reason not to do things. It's like most diets fail, most people aren't millionaires, most relationships end in divorce, or most like marriages end in divorce. And like, you don't have to be the average, but if you don't want to be the average and you don't want to like regress to the mean, then you need to live your life in a way that isn't average, that isn't what most people are doing. And like that realization that you have control over that and it's your choice how you want to behave. And do you know what, if you do what the average person does, you will probably become, or you will probably have the results that the average person has. But if you, you know, have higher expectations of yourself and set higher goals than what the average is, then act on those goals and behave in ways that many other people wouldn't do, then you can expect an incredible life and more than the average.
Yeah, it's a massive one, isn't it? Because we often use like, it's human nature as an excuse to fail at stuff. And like, oh, it's human nature that I won't, that this will happen. And it just does, like, yeah, it's human nature, but it doesn't mean you can't fight against it if it's not what you want. If you want to be better than human nature, you can beat it. It's just a little bit tougher, and it can be comforting to realize that we don't have to try at something if it's not something that we want to try at. But if it is something that we want to try and we think it's going to make our lives better to be a certain way, then why should we be constrained by, you know, everyone else not being very good at it, you know?
Yeah, I think like the prime example is like, well, everybody puts on weight as they age. Like, no, they don't. Not everybody puts on weight as they age. On average, most people do put on weight as they age, but you don't have to be the average. Like, you are an individual, you can do what you want, and there's no like reason that you have to put on weight as you age if you choose not to.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the genetics narrative as well that I have a bit of an issue with, in that genetics or your predisposition to something doesn't necessarily mean that's going to be a certainty in life. So you can be genetically predisposed for something or have certain genome. So I think so schizophrenia, for example, there's like 260 genes associated with schizophrenia, but it's largely epigenetics as to whether that's going to manifest. So if there are certain, like there are genes associated with laziness, you can use that as the most empowering or the most disempowering thing in the world, in which I have a genetic predisposition to be a bit lazier than the average person. So those naturally lean counterparts that are super active all the time, their neat is through the roof, that don't seem to put on weight, that's not going to be an issue for them. That means for me, I need to make a real concerted effort, because, you know, using that example, the law of thermodynamics still apply. It just means you need to be a little bit more conscientious and deliberate in your intentions. Because genetics, epigenetics, like, and environmental factors, nature, nurture, they all contribute to that. That's what makes it incredibly complex.
Yeah, it's the growth mindset thing as well, isn't it? And like the really interesting research by, I'm not going to say because I can't remember now, but that shows that if you're just told you're predisposed to being overweight and that's going to make you hungrier after a meal, you actually are hungrier after a meal, whether you have that genetic predisposition or not. And same with endurance performance. If you're told that you have a certain gene variant that's going to make you better at endurance performance, they found that those who were told that, whether they had that gene variant or not, performed better. So like, and I guess I'm not saying that genetics don't play a role. They absolutely do. And we've got evidence to show that they do. But what plays a bigger role, shown by that research, is your expectation of yourself. So if you expect to be more hungry, you will be. If you expect to perform better, then wow, you do perform better. So I think having that like growth mindset and not seeing those things as constraints is a really good thing. And it does make me, like, that kind of research makes me question whether it would be of use to anyone to know if they were genetically predisposed to being overweight, being hungrier, etc. Yeah. etc. Like, if there's not an outcome to that aside from work harder, then I don't know if it's particularly useful, unless you are someone who's like, I've never understood why I've always been more hungry, but now I understand it, and I understand there's nothing I can necessarily do about that, but I understand it is a bit harder for me, and that's why I find it a little bit harder. Sometimes that can be quite useful, because you're not like, oh my god, I'm just lazy or I'm just greedy. You're like, oh no, there's a reason that I seem hungrier than some of my friends. Like, that's totally normal, and that like understanding is quite useful. But if you allow that understanding to then just be like, well, I'm predisposed to always being overweight, it depends on your mindset around it.
It can be validating, but it can also be constraining at the same time, like exactly like you say. It's like I often think about this with people who you know, like we see a lot of people now that grown up have never, you know, are now being diagnosed with things like autistic spectrum disorders and stuff like that, and it makes you wonder, like, what would the difference have been if they had been diagnosed in their youth? Would they have received better services? Would they have, you know, had education aligned with what they were able to accept and all those sorts of things? Or would it have placed some, like, an invisible kind of glass ceiling in their life, where they might have, or they or their parents might have treated them differently, and they might have not realized what they were capable of, for example? It's really difficult to kind of know.
So a good example of this is when I was at school, I was diagnosed, is that even the right word, with dyslexia and borderline ADHD, right, on the spectrum, which I imagine everyone is on the spectrum to some extent. And I remember my mum was just like, you're just not very good at spelling. Like, didn't really give it any airtime. It was like, yeah, if you need to go to the extra classes, like, fine. Like, and I used to get like taken out of my class to go to these extra classes and stuff. And I actually found them really like disempowering. Mm. And I don't know, like, again, like, this is such an individual experience, but I remember the woman saying, like, you'll probably never be good at like reading or writing. I was like, well, why the fuck am I here then? Like, isn't this the whole point? Like, but anyway, I think because of honestly, primarily because of like my mum's approach to it, I guess. Like she was never like never gave me any leeway because, oh, but you're dyslexic, so you'll find that harder. It was just like, oh, you're not very, like, you have a short attention span, you need to focus more. Like, it wasn't like, oh, you've got ADHD, like, we need to change everything up for you. Yeah. And I guess looking back, like, I think that was really useful to me. But I think on the flip side of that, if you're someone who's always struggled and you can't understand why everyone else can read and write really well, and you just seem to always be behind and you're making it about yourself and you're like, I'm just stupid. When you actually understand that maybe you think in a slightly different way, and maybe this could help if you look at things in a slightly different way and you can be taught to do that, that can be really empowering. But it can also be disempowering to the same person if they take the approach of, oh, well, I'll never be able to do this, I'll just give up. So I don't know, like, I get what you're saying, Mike, like it can go one of two ways.
Yeah, I think it's how useful that information is. Because on the dyslexia thing, I know two people that spring to mind. One is incredibly well written. I only know she's dyslexic because she has told me she's dyslexic. And like she's told me she has to spend a long time piecing things together because of it. And it's so impressive because you would never guess. And on
it's same, me.
It's not you. And I also know someone that will happily write something with loads of errors and they will just put it out and say, that's because I'm dyslexic. So they can go one or two ways. And that, you know, there's no blame or judgment on that in any shape or form, but what can you do with that information? So like we often speak about mental health, childhood trauma is one of the biggest contributors towards mental health problems later in life. Can you protect all children from any sort of traumatic event? Bearing in mind, they've just all lived through a pandemic. I'm not sure you can. So it's knowing certain things and actually being able to do something with that information.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the thing, is that what does it change about the situation? Like, and that's the thing, is if it's personal information and it's just a predisposition, then it's up to you what changes. But if it's stuff like a diagnosis, for example, like if you're going to get more time in exams, for example, then yeah, it is going to, you know, it's worthwhile to have, you know, to have that diagnosis, because people can then make allowances for it. But if it's the case of, you know, if you're not going to make allowances for it, then there's no point in knowing. Like if you're going to use it to give up, I suppose, if in the example of somebody who's more predisposed to putting on weight.
I think sometimes for a lot of people, it is really helpful to understand why. Mm. And I guess this is essentially what most therapy is about, isn't it? It's like understanding why, because it's not like therapy doesn't really, all it's doing is helping you understand why you are the way that you are. And then that you can change that if you want to change that. Like a lot of the time, and I guess when I was more kind of naive to this, I was like, well, yeah, okay, so this happened in your childhood and that's the way you are now. How does that help anyone? Like, but actually there must be something in that understanding of, this is why I am the way I am and now I can change it. And otherwise, like, why would you bother going back and looking at your history? Just be like, this is the problem you're having, what's the fix we can find?
Maybe because it takes away, like we were talking about at the beginning about injustice, it takes away that sense of injustice, so there's an explanation for it, you can come to terms with it, and then you can move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, slightly off topic there, but that because we speak about quite often communication, and our frustration with other people is often that they can't communicate the same as we naturally think we may or may not have the ability to. But if an individual is brought up in a household where communication wasn't a thing, naturally that's going to have a knock-on effect to how they are as an adult.
Yeah.
So yeah, it does, I think, help make people make sense of things. Yeah.
Whose go is it, Mike? Is it your last one?
I think so.
Yeah, right. So getting over yourself is the most important obstacle to go through in any improvement process. So what I mean by that is that it's frequently our hang-ups and worries and fears and anxieties that hold us back in any change situation than it is the difficulties of the tasks themselves. So the classic example would be going to the gym. Like for somebody who doesn't feel confident to go to the gym, it's often not about the reality of of the difficulty of what that involves. It's about how it makes us feel in our heads, what we worry about people will think of us, fear of failure, fear of not, you know, of not being able to do something that you want to do, etc.
Yeah, I would say that's the biggest barrier for all my clients, really. It more like the story that they're telling themselves that they can't do something, when actually, when you break it down, like, are you actually telling me that from a practical standpoint, you can't get to the gym? No, of course. Like that isn't what you're saying. It's that you're saying that you have a mental block to doing that, and there are barriers that we need to overcome to help you do that. And again, like on any level, when people are like, oh, I can't lose weight, like on a practical level, you can't eat less. Like can, but there are reasons that you're not doing that at the moment. And I actually think that as much as that's really freaking simple, it's quite eye-opening. Sometimes I use this example and everyone's like, it's a little bit extreme, but if someone's like, oh no, I can't get 10,000 steps in, not that I ever say this, but this is just like to prove that you can. Like if I held a gun to your, like, I normally use your dog's head for some reason.
I hate this example. You've used this
yeah,
for me
I know,
before.
I use
I don't
it
even
quite
think
a lot.
About it.
But basically, like, whatever. If I was saying, like, you have to do this or I'm going to shoot your mum, like, of course you're going to do it, right? It's not an ability problem. And even if you're like, but I can't practically fit it into my life, okay, fine. But that's an aside. It's like almost just the point of stop telling yourself that you can't do things that you can. And then you're saying, I'm choosing not to do this because there are other priorities I have, which is fine. I have a job that I care about and I need to be at a desk for X hours a day. Actually, a more realistic step count for me is 8,000 steps. And I can make sure that I get that on average over the week, blah, blah, blah. There are always like ways around it. But I think opening your mind up to the realization that, you know, you can do all these things. You're just making choices given your life constraints not to do them. It is actually quite useful.
Yeah, I think many instances, there's obviously outliers, but we do get in the way of a lot of things ourselves. And we are adults with agency and choice. And it's just prioritizing those choices and being at ease with those choices sometimes. So especially over the festive season, you know, it's not to shame or make anyone feel bad about anything, but you can exercise and continue exercise habits as you would normally throughout a whole of December and be a bit lax with your eating patterns, for example. That's fine and be happy with that. Or a lot of people choose to blow out the whole of December, drink alcohol most nights, stay up until 1 o'clock in the morning watching Netflix, and then are super surprised in January when they don't feel their best. Equally okay, but you are informed to a certain extent and aware of the repercussions. So if you're making those choices, you have to take some self-responsibility for them as well.
Yeah, own your actions, I think, is probably one of the biggest life lessons. It's just every action has a consequence and you have to own that. And whether it's your fault or not, and I think this is a big one, like take responsibility for it, because the responsibility is where your power is. Like if it's out of your control and you have no responsibility and you're saying you can't do things, like then yeah, like you don't have any control, you don't have any power, you don't have any autonomy. But if you're saying like, I'm taking ownership for this, whether it's my fault for this situation or not, that's where your power is to make change.
Mm-hmm.
Dan, what was your last one?
I'm going to crowbar it in because actually it quite closely aligns with your second one, I think. And I just put value-led purpose, meaning of fulfillment's where it's at.
So
where it's at, pal, down with the kids, because just purpose gives greater meaning, which inadvertently contributes to how fulfilled you feel doing things. And I think from a coaching standpoint, that's kind of the job, which I don't actually feel like is a job, is helping others find meaning and purpose in their actions or their quest for behavior change, for example. And that, again, inadvertently making other people feel seen, heard, and like they matters massively. And it's not quite altruism, but that contributes to how fulfilled we find ourselves as well. Mm-hmm. And that helps us find purpose and fulfillment in what we're doing. So much as I think we've had the chat on a live before, Em, is you can view things as hard work or just work, but often finding purpose and fulfillment in those things is the differentiator there.
Yeah, I think that if you have real purpose and you really understand like why you're doing something, you'll outwork everyone. Like, and yeah. It won't even feel like hard work.
But that has to be value led, because if you deviate away from your personal values, which comes from that self-awareness, is you will naturally find yourselves, as I have done this year as a confession, feeling a bit conflicted at times.
Yeah. I think if your business and your life generally is based on your values, you can't really go that far wrong. And there'll always be like mistakes along the way or like perceived failures along the way, but it's always the right decision if you still think that was aligned with my values. And actually something I've been thinking about recently is how we view decisions. And we normally view whether a decision was good or bad based on the outcome. So we're like, oh, that was a good decision to run across the road on a red light or like without a green man because I didn't get run over and now I'm at the other side quicker. This is a really shit example. But like, it wouldn't have been a good decision if you got run over, would it? But it's actually the same decision. It was still a bad decision to go out into the road when you could have been run over. Just because the outcome was positive, it doesn't make it a positive decision. And like the same is true for things like investments and stuff. Like just because an investment turned out well, it doesn't necessarily mean it was a good decision if there were a load of red flags there. And generally in life, I think we think about that as well. Like, oh, that wasn't a good decision because it didn't turn out well. Okay, well, if you went back there now, and was that decision like based on your values and based on what you thought was best at the time? Yes. So it was a good decision. And I think it really clouds your judgment of decision making going forward when you base your decisions on the outcome, because you're like, oh well, I did that last time and it worked really well, and you can think, oh, running out in front of cars is a really good decision because last time I didn't get run over. No, it's still a bad decision. Please don't run out in front of cars. There.
Is that your third lesson?
probably should have been. My third one's really quick. It's take more risks, see life as an adventure, find someone who will go on adventures with you because life is better when you have someone to share adventures with. And I think on top of that, like it doesn't have to be, if you're like, yeah, but I'm single, like it doesn't have to be a partner. In fact, it could be you that you're taking out on adventures. Obviously mine is Amelia, but it could be anyone. Yeah. And I think like take more risks, not less risks. Just make sure that they're good decisions, not based on the outcome, you know, and align with your values. There you go.
Yeah. I think if you haven't reflected on the last couple of years and realized how finite life really is on that risk thing, because we do, again, back to the point on us being in the way of our own way sometimes of things, it's life is bloody short, without being too morbid to finish the podcast.
Mm-hmm. Life is short, take more risks, understand that even if you think things are, I don't know, settled, like they're not anyway. What am I trying to say? That you have less control than you think anyway, so I guess don't stress over the fact that you don't have control because you don't have it anyway.
Yeah.
All right, well, I hope everyone has lovely New Year's. And we will be back in the new year. We actually have some pretty freaking incredible guests lined up. So I'm really excited about at least the first couple of Fitness Unfiltered episodes for next year.
Yeah. Please like, share, review and all that stuff. That helps us massively with reach and obviously getting to as many ear holes as possible.
Freak out when you say ear holes.
Well, because no one really likes anything going in their ear holes, do they?
Apart from a wet willy.
Well, hashtag consent.
Yeah, you are. Well, true. Okay, right. Ending here.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.